The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
You're listening to UK Health Radio. Welcome to the Therapy Suite. I'm Duncan Ellison, a therapeutic counsellor with a focus on positive mental health. This week in the headlines, the DWP admit to getting benefits wrong, and Apple shareholders are concerned about children and mobile devices. Learn what life is like as a carer and how to manage your mental health. If mindfulness is your thing, stay tuned, and we'll take another look at TA and how it works. Music from Robbie Williams and Tasmin Archer, and wise words on the way. So keep it locked to UK Health Radio and join me, Duncan Ellison, as we open the doors to the Therapy Suite. Mental health news making the headlines this week. More than 160,000 people with mental health problems could receive back payments from the Department of Work and Pensions after the government admitted people may have missed out on benefits. The DWP says it won't dispute a High Court ruling that the benefits system blatantly discriminates against people with mental health problems. The ruling in December found an amendment to personal independence payments that limited the amount of support people with psychological distress could receive. Summing up the case, which was brought by a woman with mental health problems, the judge said the regulation could not be objectively justified. In response, the DWP said, "We will then write to those individuals affected, and all payments will be backdated to the effective date in each individual claim." Disability campaigners have hailed the announcement as a victory for disabled people who've been unable to access support they're entitled to. They said it would come as a huge relief for many people with mental health disabilities. There could be unintentional side effects if children continue to be attached to their phones, a report suggests recently. Apple has been told to take urgent action to curb children's smartphone addiction amid fears that technology could be damaging the young generation. The warning from two shareholders comes amid increasing concerns about how gadgets and social media could affect the young children who use them, many of whom are attached to their phones for many hours a day. While tech companies have not acknowledged openly that their gadgets may be addictive, some Silicon Valley insiders have begun to speak to media about how gadgets, mobile applications, and social media sites are designed to be addictive and to keep users' attention as long as possible. The aim of the proposal to Apple is to establish an expert committee, including child development specialists, and to offer Apple's vast information to researchers, whilst also enhancing the mobile device software so that parents have more options to protect their children's health. Also in the news, insurers have been accused of depriving access to life insurance and other kinds of cover to people with depression and anxiety, even for physical conditions unrelated to their mental health. People who have suffered even mild mental health conditions or one-off episodes say they have been refused life insurance altogether, aggravating their financial insecurity. Dozens of complainants have been in touch with a national newspaper. Charities and campaigners described the findings as extremely worrying and showed that insurers were operating based on an outdated understanding of mental illness. Charities warned that gaps in the law mean customers have little protection against this form of prejudice. The difficulty is that the only protection available is to people who are disabled under the Equality Act, said Michael Henson-Webb, head of legal at mental health charity Mind. He continues, "The current definition of a disability under the Act doesn't cover everyone with a mental health problem and makes it difficult for individuals with mental health problems and their legal advisers to clearly determine their rights." Those who complained to the newspaper said that discrimination had made them wary of getting further treatment. Finally, the Duchess of Cambridge will be continuing her work of boosting mental health in young people by launching a new schools programme. A visit to Roe Green Junior School in Brent marked the launch of the programme recently, with pupils and teachers taking part in a lesson designed to help support a child's mental health and well-being. Coordinated and financed by the Royal Foundation, the mental health project has been developed by the youth-focused charity partners of Heads Together, the Anna Freud National Centre for Children and Families, Place to Be and Young Minds. The project is part of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and Prince Harry's Heads Together campaign. For the Duchess, supporting young people is a key focus of her work at the Royal Foundation. Looking back at the news this week, the DWP said it would not appeal a High Court ruling last month that found changes to the disability benefits system blatantly discriminated against people with mental health problems. The new Work and Pension Secretary, Esther McVeigh, said the DWP would take all the steps necessary to implement the judgment by going through all affected PIP claimants to identify anyone who may be entitled to additional support as a result of the case. Deborah Abrahams, MP and Labour's Shadow Work and Pension Secretary, said the ruling showed yet more evidence of the duplicity and disarray of the government in social security policies. She added that questions remain over how many people were affected and how much public money has been shed out on this particular case. Announcing the DWP would not appeal last month, Ms. McVeigh said, "Supporting people with mental health conditions is a top priority for the government. We're committed to ensuring our welfare system is a strong safety net for those who need it. That is why we spend over £50 billion a year supporting people with disabilities and health conditions, more than ever before. Disabled people and people with health conditions, including mental health, deserve the very best support." Mark Atkinson, chief executive of the disability charity Scope, said, "It's absolutely right that the government has accepted the High Court's ruling over the discriminatory changes made to the PIP last year. This announcement is a victory for the many disabled people who've been unable to access support they are entitled to." The regulations introduced last March made crude and unfair distinctions between those with physical impairments and those with mental health conditions. Thousands of disabled people rely on PIP to live independently and meet the often substantial extra costs they face related to their condition or impairment. While those affected by these misguided changes will now receive the payments they are entitled to, the fundamentally flawed PIP assessment process still needs radically overhauling, so it accurately identifies the extra costs disabled people face. We also heard that two of the controlling investors at Apple have warned that the company needs to lead the way in giving parents and their children more powerful ways of keeping phone use in check. They said last week in an open letter to Apple that the company must offer more choices and tools to help children fight addiction to its devices. There is a developing consensus around the world, including Silicon Valley, that the potential long-term consequences of new technologies need to be factored in at the outset. And no company can outsource that responsibility, the letter said. Apple can play a defining role in signalling to the industry that paying special attention to the health and development of young people is both good business and a right thing to do. The two investors collectively control £2 billion worth of Apple shares. The proposals to Apple include establishing an expert committee, including child development specialists, offer Apple's vast information to researchers, and to enhance mobile device software so that parents have more options to protect their children's health. The letter cited various studies and surveys on how the heavy usage of smartphones and social media negatively affects children's mental and physical health. Examples include distractions by digital technologies in the classroom, a decreased ability of students to focus on educational tasks, and higher risks of suicide and depression. The investors' call reflects growing concerns around the world about what long-term impacts will be of using mobile devices and social media, especially for those who start to use smartphones at an early age. But surely it can't be left on the shoulders of the manufacturers to ensure the welfare of young people. Some would argue that if parents are concerned about the result of using smartphones, then they shouldn't buy one for their child in the first place. Whilst this may sound like an easy resolve, peer pressure might prove harder to overcome. As we heard also in the news this week, insurers have been accused of depriving access to life insurance and other kinds of cover to people with depression and anxiety. In some cases, insurers appear to base their refusal on long-distant episodes of depression or anxiety, or when customers admit to having suicidal thoughts or self-harming noted on their medical records. These customers are then allegedly deemed unsuitable to insure, even for circumstances where death is not linked to a mental health condition. One refused applicant was a victim of the July 7th bombings in London, who experienced post-traumatic stress disorder. She described being turned down as upsetting and worrying, saying it showed ignorance about mental illnesses. I was never given a specific explanation as to why I was rejected, but I have not got any physical health issues, said the woman, who did not wish to be identified. Others say they were penalised after attending one or two grief counselling sessions following a family death, leading to rocketing premiums. Laura Peters, a vice manager at Rethink Mental Illness, said, "What is judged as high risk seems to be based on an increasingly outdated understanding of mental illness. This viewpoint is resulting in people being disproportionately penalised for their condition with eye-watering premiums or flat-out rejection. It feels to me wholly inappropriate and discriminatory. This is something that the government needs to investigate as a matter of urgency. We need to get a fundamental review of these policies." Even those who work in the insurance industry think the practice of declining or penalising individuals based on their mental health is just odd. One insurance broker who asked to remain anonymous said, "Some insurers target different markets and like clean lives. It sounds awful, but they are hard-nosed businesses." He added, "My wife looked to apply for a new cover recently, and she'd gone to her GP about work-related stress, and the insurer automatically increased the premium. How many people go through work-related stress? I thought the premium increase was ludicrous." A spokesperson for the Royal London said, "Most mental health conditions are mild or self-limiting, and as a result, we're able to offer standard rates to more than 90% of customers who inform us of their condition." An Aviva spokesperson said, "We take our responsibility to comply with the Equality Act 2010 very seriously. The Act includes special rules that permit insurers to assess customers individually and to offer acceptance terms at the standard rate, an increased premium rate, or to refuse offer cover based on each individual applicant's risk." And finally, we heard the Duchess of Cambridge is continuing her work by boosting mental health in young people by launching a new schools programme. The NAHT, the School Leaders Association, has been engaged in developing the initiative with guidance from the Centre for Mental Health. The launch event, which was also attended by the Minister for Schools, Nick Gibb, included speeches from Simon Marshall, Director of Educational Services at Together for Children, and Julie Greer, a head teacher at Sherborough Primary School, which is taking part in the pilot project. The project is part of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and Prince Harry's Heads Together campaign. For the Duchess, supporting young people is a key focus of her work at the Royal Foundation. Up next, we'll be taking a look at what it's like to deal with mental health as a carer. In the meantime, let's listen to what happens when you think you have a mental health condition.
My first mental health problems were when I was about 14. 15, and I started seeing this big scarecrow man, like 8 foot tall, big bag on his head. I wasn't sure what to think about it at first, but when I moved, and then voices started, and eventually it started affecting my work, and a lot of teachers had to go at me for forgetting my homework and all this sort of stuff because I couldn't remember anything. So I started going to see a doctor, and they diagnosed me psychotic psychosis bordering paranoid schizophrenia. I think that was the diagnosis at the time. And then I can't remember what it was called, but it was an anxiety disorder as well. And then I went to, after a little while, I really struggled with that and I was hospitalised. And I stayed there for a long, quite a while. And then after I got really, I came, I remember I had to go back and forth from the hospital to go do my GCSEs, which was like a special arrangement they had with the school. So I didn't do my GCSEs in with everyone else. I did them in my own little room. I guess at school, they sort of have to tell other people just in case. But I had a lot of people whose parents wouldn't let their children be friends with me anymore. And even now, sometimes I'll go to relatives' house, or friends' relatives' houses and stuff, and they won't leave their kids alone in the room or anything like that, which is really not nice. Prominently, I have two voices. The first one that sort of turned up was Norman Bates, who's is just sort of, it sounds just like Anthony Perkins does in the film. And he sort of, he's more direct talk, he talks directly sometimes. And then I got Humphrey Bogart was the other one. And he's now, he's more third person. Like he says, like, Juno's making tea, Juno's doing this, and stuff like that. While Norman's more, he says, watch out for the guy behind you. Like he might be stealing your blood and stuff. And I'm not on any antipsychotics at the moment because personally I've had not very nice experience with them. Like they made me gain weight, and also they made me really blunt, like getting up and stuff and making sure I could just talk, even just sometimes just talking is a really a lot of effort to start talking. My friends know now that I can't go out clubbing or anything like that or being really busy areas. I mean, getting here was pretty tough, but like being in busy areas, they know like it's much better if we stay at home or something, or go to like a quiet pub or something during the day, and like going home at night especially. And my best friend, he lives in the next town over, and he always makes sure I get a lift home and to him and stuff, because I can't go on my own, which is really nice. My girlfriend, she's really supportive. She handles the money and stuff because I can't. As soon as I see numbers, I start getting strange and can't figure it out. So she handles that. She also makes sure, she always checks every couple of minutes to make sure I'm all right. She doesn't leave me alone. If I'm out, if we're out, she won't wander off somewhere. She'll make sure I'm there and knows where she is. If you try and pinpoint, like, that's a hallucination, that's a hallucination, you just have to keep reminding yourself that's a hallucination. But then lately, within the last sort of 3 months, it's getting much harder to be like, I don't know if that's a hallucination and if I'm making that up. It's very hard to, because it's even little things like a cup on the side, you're like, I don't know if that's there. And then you start questioning everything, like, is that everything here? Is that cupboard there or something? Or is that tap dripping or anything like that? You start questioning everything, and that's when it's a slippery slope.
The Therapy Suite.
Tell someone to love me, I need to rest in arms. Keep me safe from harm, I'm pouring rain. Give me endless summer, Lord, I feel the cold. Feel I'm getting old before my time. As my soul heals the shame, I will grow through this pain. Lord, I'm doing all I can to be a better man. Go easy on my conscience, 'cause it's not my fault. I know I've been told to take the blame. Rest assured, my angels will catch my tears, walk me out of here. I'm in pain. My soul heals the shame, I will grow through this pain. Lord, I'm doing all I can to be a better man. for someone to love me. I need to rest in arms, keep me safe from harm, from pouring rain. Give me endless summer, Lord, I fear the cold. I feel I'm getting old before my time. As my soul heals the shame, will grow through this pain. Lord, I'm doing all I can to be a better man.
Wise words on the way, music from Tasmin Archer still to come, and in this week's Toolbox Talk, I'll be sharing more TA information. Supporting or caring for somebody is no easy task, so it's no surprise that being in this position can be a drain on your mental health. You are a carer if you provide unpaid support and care for somebody who has an illness, disability, mental health problem, or addiction. People often assume that carers tend to be women, but research shows that around 4 in 10 carers are men. Being someone's carer probably only describes part of your relationship with them. You may also be a parent, partner, sibling, friend, or other family member. Supporting others can be mentally and physically exhausting. The time you spend caring can vary too. Some people look after someone for just a short period of time, and others find themselves caring for someone for much longer terms. I've picked the following information off the Mind website, and it's been written by Claire. She starts by saying, "Both my husband and I manage anxiety and depression. We're lucky in a way, as this means we are each able to understand what it feels like to be on the inside of these experiences. We've both needed and given support at different times. Recently, I've been more vulnerable as I've been struggling with medication withdrawal symptoms. We've set ourselves up as a team and we deal with things together. I have urges of anger and irritability that disguise themselves as reactions to things happening day to day. They include harsh comments, slamming doors, and helpless tears. My husband recognizes these symptoms and he knows that deep down, they're not my fault." Claire has put a 6-point plan together on how her and her husband deal with their mental health. Distinguish between the relationship issues and the mental health problems. This stops any confusion as to what the problem is and to what the cause may be. We deal with things together. Finding a language to help each other understand. Describe and make a note of the feelings, so whenever they do happen again, they can be easily identifiable. Finding new tools and techniques can be valuable, and in ways you don't quite expect. Claire says, "I use the description of negative fog in my mind that magnifies and bounces every thought back at me. Saying, I feel a bit foggy tonight. I think I'm going to go to bed. This helps her partner understand rather than just saying, I don't feel too good today. We try to explain how anxiety and depression affect how we feel and behave and recognise these symptoms not as reality. A symptom of my depression is feeling needy and over-dependent. Because these are negative experiences one might have in a relationship anyway, it's important to identify that they are a result of the depression. Sometimes other people can put things into words better than we can. Saying, I'm low, I feel needy, so I might be a bit dependent and irrational today, sets me up much better to manage. This also helps my husband understand my expectations. Enlist each other's help and don't disregard it. When I feel depressed and it's hard to imagine I'll ever feel better, I often need help to be reminded about what feeling better feels like. I know my husband can help, and I try to listen to him, even if in the moment I genuinely can't believe him. Knowing he knows me and wants the best for me means it's easier to trust him when he's encouraging me to take a shower or attend my counselling appointments. He also helps me take notice of the warning signs of a relapse and encourages me to look after myself. Read up and learn more. There are lots of pages of advice online, some of it useful and some of it I disregard. It helps us understand the issues and how we can help each other. We share anything that makes sense or describes how we feel. Sometimes other people can put things into words much better than we can. It isn't easy, but there are times when it's desperate, exhausting, and miserable. But overall, I think we're stronger, more honest, and more resilient as a result of standing shoulder to shoulder when times get hard. For more mental health tips or information, check out the Mind website, www.mind.org.uk. Coming up, Tasmin Archer plays next, and then more about TA. But in the meantime, here are three carers comparing notes with their session at Mind.
I became this carer without really knowing I was a carer. I just was there, putting one foot in front of the other, trying to keep going to help my husband and fighting his corner for him. And it never occurred to me that there was any support for me.
Yeah.
And because I've got my own mental health condition, and I, you know, stress is a trigger for that, and I just kind of disregarded it. I was just gonna keep try to keep going and fight every day. And it wasn't until much later on that when the CPNs were involved that they said, well, what about you? Have you got support? And I thought, not really. Yeah. But I got friends and family, but I had nothing. I had no official sort of support in place.
I think I've had like a bit of a mixed experience with sort of support from school or education, employment and stuff. My last job was surprisingly unsupportive, given the field of work I was in. I asked for time off. There's a procedure for it, but I've asked for like time off quite quickly. And no one told me that there was such a thing as carer's leave. They insisted that I took it all out of my annual leave, and then when I asked afterwards if I could sort of switch it around and give it back to me, they didn't do it. But then when I was at uni, they were really supportive. I had to come home for a month, and it was right at sort of deadline time, and they gave me extensions, and they were really...
That's really good to hear. It's kind of luck of the draw sometimes.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of time we don't think of us being affected by things. We keep walking, we keep going to work, we do things when we come home, and everybody thinks we are fit.
Yeah.
So unless you collapse,
yeah,
then they will say you're sick. Mm. But, you know, I feel like, you know, that's why the support for us, I think, as carers, are not there in the beginning. They let us get on with it and then wait till we reach the point where we can't do any more, and then they will come in to support us. But then it's too late. Sometimes it could be worse for us.
Yeah.
Mm.
To support the other person.
And I think because of the mental health aspect as well, in the start when you talked about not considering yourself a carer,
mm-hmm,
I didn't, because I wasn't associating it with the stuff that people do when caring for, say, somebody with dementia or somebody with a physical disability.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I saw at my GP's that there was a carers network, and I thought, well, that doesn't really apply to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But actually, eventually I signed up for it, and they were good. They said, yes, we can do X, Y, and Z for you, and make sure you get a flu jab, practical things like that, you know, that to make sure that my health was good, because I suppose my health needs to be good to look after him.
So. That's right, yeah. In the beginning, I didn't want to take help from other people and other family members, because I thought I would be looking at him as weak and not able to look after my own child. So I didn't want to approach him in that way.
Yeah.
But then it came to a point, I said, well, if I don't get them involved, how far will I go? So I had to use a different strategy, like, you know, for them to come and help. And they were very supportive, you know, and that's helped a lot. And I realized that if you don't take help, if it's out there, then you are on your own, and it will not do any good to your health and your well-being yourself. So having the family or friends and networking with others has helped a lot, and I've seen the difference now.
I'm one of these people who insists on being incredibly independent and, you know, I can cope with it all on my own. But when I did, when I told people what was going on, I think when people knew about it, they were so supportive, and it was an enormous source of help, it really was. And our families don't live locally, so it was quite a distance for them to travel to be with us, but they offered to if we needed that help. Mm. And just friends, being able to offload everything onto friends. So very good to just sit and talk, and they let me talk. They let me just pour everything out, and were really understanding. And a few of them have been through it as well and know what's going on.
I think as well, I think for me at least, I feel that by being able to talk to other people, friends, family, whatever, about what was going on to do with my mum's health, it's kind of made me more able to talk about everything else. You know, you kind of sort of like
get your confidence to talk to people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that in that way, it's kind of like made me a lot more balanced, and that before, or for a long time anyway, I was quite an insular person. Like, still outgoing, but I just was never one to like talk about problems or like bad stuff. Yeah. And I think that by doing that, it kind of sort of like paved the way, I suppose, to being able to talk about other things and being honest about like how you feel about certain things. And like, because I think that's part of the problem, isn't it? If you hold everything in for too long,
we hold it inside. We don't want people to know what's happening to us.
You're listening to UK Health Radio.
I blame you for the moonlit sky and the dream that died with the eagle's flight. I blame you for the moonlit nights when I wonder why are the seas still dry. Don't blame me. Dream that died with the eagle's flight.
Before we move on, if you have a mental health story to tell, whether it's your journey or someone close to you, or if you run a mental health project, do get in touch either on Twitter at Duncan_Ellison or email duncan@thinkduncan.com. A few weeks ago, UK Health Radio exhibited at the Best You Expo, which took place at Olympia in London. The name of the show itself should give you an idea of the kind of people who were there. It was an opportunity to meet many inspirational people, and I made some great friends at the show too. And hopefully, over the next few months, I'll start introducing them here on the Therapy Suite. One person who really blew my mind was Deborah McCabe. She runs an organisation called Meditate to Silence. Following 30 years in the IT sector, she knew a thing or two about stress and depression. Now, you wouldn't know this when you meet her. She is totally chilled out and has a real sense of warmth about her. So why not let Deborah pick this up from here and tell you more about the benefits of meditation in support of positive mental health.
Hello. People often ask me what mindfulness is, and there are various usual explanations. It's being in the present moment. It's when you think about your thoughts, isn't it? Don't you have to meditate all the time? But for me, the answer is mindfulness and meditation is life-changing, because quite simply, it has changed the way I live my life. I suffer from chronic depression for many years, and after discovering firstly meditation, then mindfulness, I found a way to live my life virtually free of depression, which is huge. I'm not saying my depression has gone altogether. I still take my medication, which I will continue to do. I have been on the roller coaster of on meds and off meds, and I really don't want to do that anymore. But now I can see my depression coming. I can observe it as though I'm outside my body, and I can react to it differently. Whereas 4 years ago, I would spend months retreating to my bed at every opportunity. Now it is only for a few days. Now instead of sleeping for hours, I meditate, and the difference is liberating. I would sleep for hours, drag myself to work, get home and sleep again. I would spend entire weekends in bed. Now I meditate, sometimes from my bed. A body scan is great when you're feeling very low. But then I find I'm up and I'm in the kitchen making tea or tidying up. I might feel another dip a few hours later, so I do another meditation and I slowly begin to feel better. And the reason I do this is because I want to return to my settled mind, my inner mind, to regain its power over the darkness, and meditation enables me to do that. Mindfulness is also in play throughout. When I start thinking bad thoughts such as no one needs me, no one loves me, or I'm useless, I catch those thoughts and I question them. Really? Is that really true? And simply by questioning them, my lighter mind gains the upper hand. It may just be for a few moments or an hour, but it does get stronger. So the more I meditate, the more I am mindful, the quicker my mind changes back to its normal, sensible, loving state. One last thing. This week, switch off from all your technology for at least 30 minutes a day. See how you feel. What are your thoughts? This simple action can give your mind the breathing space it needs. I will explain why next week.
This is UK Health Radio. My name's Duncan, and I'll be with you every other week to put a new twist on mental health. If you like this show and want more, you can listen to all the different programs UK Health Radio has to offer. You can choose the live play schedule or download your favorite programs on demand wherever, whenever you need to. Continuing on from last month's programme, when I introduced the concept of transactional analysis, let's remind ourselves about the theory and practice. Being clinically correct, it's a psychoanalytic therapy wherein each social transaction is analysed to determine the involved ego state, whether parent-like, child-like, or adult-like, as a basis for understanding behaviour. Transactional analysis was created by psychotherapist Dr. Eric Byrne, who was born in 1910 and died in 1970. From studies he conducted in the 1950s, he made complex interpersonal transactions understandable after he realized that people interact from one of three ego states: the parent, the adult, and the child. Each one of the ego states is a system of communication with its own language and function. The parent's language is one of values. The adult's is a language of logic and rationality. The child's is a language of emotions. Each one of the ego states is a system of communication with its own language and function. Dr. Byrne's most famous book, Games People Play, opened up a new era of understanding about the complexity of overt and covert interpersonal communications. And this works really well in the workplace. It enhances a manager's appreciation of the impact of their communication efforts. Intended or not, there are certainly a few things we can learn. In this particular model, the sender is always the person who initiates the transaction or communication interaction. There's always a receiver of the communication, and the overall reaction is either complementary or crossed. Since the adult ego state is all about logic and rationality, we would ideally like to ensure that all communication in the workplace are adult to adult. After all, we're all supposed to act like adults, and that should be the basis of the vast majority of our communication in the workplace. But in reality, it often doesn't work that way. So let's examine the crossed transaction. In the crossed transaction, the most frequently problematic issue is the parent-child communication. First, let's remind ourselves of a couple of key facts about this model. We possess all three ego states in our consciousness. Your personality is a result of your life experiences. Who you are as a parent, an adult, or a child is a function of these experiences, no matter how you may wish to depart from them. Although we can learn new behaviours and skills, often what we intend in a transaction is not how the receiver interprets it. A typical transaction in a work environment will be, or rather should be, parent to parent or adult to adult. The receiver, however, may not share this view, in which case it becomes a parent to child transaction. The parent is like a tape recorder. Yeah, do you remember those? It's a collection of pre-recorded, prejudged, prejudiced codes for living. When a person is in the parent ego state, they feel they behave like one of their own parents or someone who took their place. The parent decides, without reasoning, how to react to situations, what is good or bad, and how people should live. The parent judges for or against and can be controlling or supportive. When the parent is critical, it's called the critical parent. When it's supportive, it's called the nurturing parent. When in the adult ego state, the person functions as a human computer. It operates on data it collects and stores, and uses that to make decisions according to a logic-based program. When in the adult ego state, the person uses logical thinking to solve problems, making sure that child or parent emotions do not contaminate the process. And when we're in the child ego state, we act like the child we once were. We aren't just putting on an act. We think, we feel, we see, hear, and react as a 3, 5, or 8-year-old child. The ego states are fully experienced states of being, not just roles. And when the child is hateful or loving, impulsive, spontaneous, or playful, it's called the natural child. When it's thoughtful, creative, or imaginative, it's called the little professor. When it's fearful, guilty, or ashamed, it's called the adapted child. The child has all the feelings: fear, love, anger, joy, sadness, shame, and so on. These three kinds of personality also work with what we call the drama triangle. Have a listen to Patrick Wannis as he explains more.
Hello, I'm Patrick Wannis, human behaviour expert, PhD. What role do you play in relationships? Now, before you say, whoa, hold on, I don't play any roles. I'm me, I'm authentic, I'm just me. Well, consider the following. Do you engage in what we call the drama triangle? The drama triangle consists of three dynamics: the victim, the persecutor, and the hero. The victim is the person that says, I'm helpless, I'm oppressed. Everyone's doing this to me. I don't have any power. I'm completely powerless, and I'm dependent on you, and I need someone to rescue me. So along comes the rescuer. The rescuer is the hero. The hero says, you are helpless, and you really can't live or survive without me. So you're going to become dependent on me, and I'm going to save you. I'm going to rescue you. Then we have the switching or fluid dynamic of the persecutor. The victim might turn into the persecutor and say, see what you've done to me, this is why I'm a victim, because you're bad and it's all your fault. And then the victim becomes the persecutor, and the persecutor becomes really angry, remains rigid, blames, condemns, criticizes, and judges. Now, as I've just explained, these are not gender-based roles, and they're quite fluid. One day, a person can be the victim. The next day, they might be the persecutor. However, we tend to stay fixed in these roles. If we find out that the way to get love and attention is by playing victim, we'll continue to play the victim in one relationship after another. If we find that the way to stay safe and still get some sort of love, but lots of attention, is to be the rescuer, then we'll continue to rescue people from one relationship to another. If we find another way to stay safe is to blame everyone else, then we'll become the persecutor. And we'll blame everyone else and say, it's your fault, and we'll continue to play and repeat that role in one relationship after another. As I've also just explained, what is the intention of each of these behaviors, each of these roles? As a very twisted way of getting love and attention. But ultimately, it's not real love. When you have a relationship that involves two or three of these dynamics, that is, the victim, the rescuer, and the persecutor, there isn't real love expressed. The victim can't be real. The victim can never tap into his or her own power. The victim can never really experience and realize his or her full potential. The rescuer can never receive love because he or she is always trying to rescue and save and give to everyone else. And the persecutor can never feel fully alive because he or she always has a big wall around them and never allows him or herself to become vulnerable. And so therefore, real love isn't being expressed. Take a look in your relationship or the relationships around you. Who's playing victim, rescuer, and persecutor? Incidentally, this game can't be played once the victim stops playing the victim. In my next video, I'll also give you the complete solution to resolve and come up with a better dynamic than the victim, the persecutor, and the rescuer. Meanwhile, if you'd like to learn more about the drama triangle, victim, rescuer, and persecutor, go to patrickwannis.com. I'm Patrick Wannis.
We're coming towards the end of the show, and I do hope you've enjoyed it. So let's wrap up with this week's wise words. Life is like riding a bicycle. To keep your balance, you must keep moving. Don't forget, if you do have any mental health concerns or have been affected by anything raised on today's programme, please consult your GP or find a counselling service to talk to. You've been listening to The Therapy Suite with me, Duncan Ellison, only on UK Health Radio. Stay well, keep smiling, and I'll see you next time.